I'll need my guns to fight off your attack dog. Over the radio, they say he's already in the house. McSpatten, if you see my attack dog, the last bloody thing that will save you will be a gun in your hand. You might take off your white underpants and swing them in surrender if you haven't managed to soil them yet. Come now, lad. You understand what you're up against. You can only save yourself by helping us.
Claire saw the man shuffle his boots like he was going to run away, but instead, he moved back to her grandpa. A hand reached down, lifted one of his trouser legs, and yanked a shiny silver gun from it. Claire put her hand over Kate's mouth to squelch a scream.
I'll leave you my backup, just a little six-shooter.
It's a fine one, Letty. Now, off you go. Back out the door to guard us in case Regal or that psycho Lloyd come to check. You see the gray man, tell him you're with me.
Right, that'll work fine just as long as he wants to chat me up first. I'm fucked, Fitzroy.
The guard's feet turned away and left the room. A few seconds later, Grandpa Donald slid off the bed and crawled under with them, the shiny gun clenched in his meaty hand.
It's all right, ladies. Won't be long now. Jimmy Boy is on the way.
Regal, Lloyd, and the tech remained in the third-floor control room. Lloyd stood near the open door out to the hallway, his pistol dangling in his right hand, his dusky blue shirt collar open, and the knot of his tie hanging below it. Kurt and the tech were at the computers, near the shattered window and midway between the room's two exits. They used radios to communicate with the remaining Belarusians throughout the building and the two French engineers on the first floor. One of the Scots was missing, but the other Scot and an Irishman were still on station. Gunfire erupted suddenly on the roof. The big German presumed these would be the Saudis from the Eurocopter engaging the sniper team through the turret windows. He called the Scottish security officer and ordered him up to the third floor to cover the hall outside the room's main exit. Just then, one of the Belarusians announced that the Sri Lankans were here, coming up the front drive. A call went out to the sniper team on the roof, but there was no reply. And no one knew where the gray man had gone. Regal knew his only mission now was his own survival. He did not need the gray man dead. That mission had expired. That said, if Gentry came through either the door to the hall on his right, or the doorway to the circular staircase to his left, if anyone came in from anywhere, he would put three rounds from his big Steyr into their face before he bothered to identify them. He just had to hold out until the rescue ship arrived from the Home Office. Court wanted to crouch low as he moved through the house, but the pain in his abdomen prevented it. If push came to shove, which surely it would, he could drop, roll, crawl, whatever he had to do. But he was afraid that if he had to squat low or dive to the floor, he might not be able to get back up. So he walked fully upright, nearly dragging his numb left leg behind him. Into the huge kitchen now, he heard gunfire above him, on the third floor, or the roof, perhaps. On the first floor, near the foyer, it sounded to the gray man's practiced ear like a one-versus-many battle had just ended, and now a new threat had arrived, maybe 4-on-4. He recognized the distinctive reports of AK-47s and 12-gauge shotguns, and shouts in what sounded like Russian on one side of the fight. Court crossed the kitchen. He'd almost made it to a door towards the rear of the chateau, away from the shooting, when a black man in a brown suit appeared in the doorway in front of him. Court trained his MP5 on the wide-eyed man.
Who are you?
Only the butler, sir. I have no part in this.
Gentry grabbed the man by the throat and turned him up against the wall. With the hot muzzle of his weapon pressed against the thin man's neck, the American frisked his prisoner quickly and found not a single weapon. Court tossed the man's cell phone into a pot of water sitting on the stove next to him. He found no identification.
What's your name?
Felix.
Let me guess. Felix the Nigerian butler?
No, sir. I am from Cameroon.
Sure you are, buddy.
Court pushed the man towards the door out of the back of the kitchen. The black man kept his hands in the air as he walked, Gentry several feet behind him. They crossed an ornate dining room with a fireplace with gilded trim and rounded the huge oaken table. Tapestries and portraits lined the walls.
Stepping into a small hallway with a door immediately on their left,
Gentry whispered again to the man in front of him.
What's in there?
A hesitation.
It's a bedroom.
Not sure. A butler who doesn't know the rooms of the house.
I told you, a bedroom. I am new here, sir. I am scared.
Open it. Let's see if you're right.
Court drew his Glock and held it down the hallway behind him with his left hand, while he held the MP5 at Felix's head with his right. The suited man opened the door and turned back to the gray man.
Court looked in over his shoulder.
There were stacked sheets and blankets in shelves from floor to ceiling. It was not a bedroom. It was a large linen closet.
If you are a butler, you suck.
Felix said nothing. The gunfire at the front of the house continued without pause. Court holstered the Glock on his hip and took his last fragmentation grenade off his vest. He pulled the pin and put it in his pocket, held the spoon down, and placed it in Felix's sweaty hand. When the American assassin was certain his prisoner had a good hold, he said,
"Don't drop that. And don't think you can use it against me. There's a 6-second fuse. Plenty of time for me to shoot you dead and duck into a room to get clear of the blast."
Felix's voice cracked.
"What am I to do with?"
"Just keep walking ahead of me. I'll take it back from you and let you leave once I get to my objective. Don't worry. You'll be back home in Cameroon in no time."
The corridor turned to the left and ended at a large set of double doors. Court shoved the confused man forward. Twice the man tried to speak, and both times Gentry hushed the strong African accent.
"Open those doors,"
Court demanded, still behind at the turn in the passageway.
"But I..."
Gentry pointed his submachine gun at his prisoner's head. Slowly, Felix turned back around, opened the door on the right, the grenade hidden behind his back in his left hand. Almost immediately, cracks of handgun fire echoed out of the room ahead, and oak splinters snapped off the heavy doors. Felix spun where he stood, fell face down in the doorway. Court spun out of the line of fire, dropped onto his knee pads with a grunt, and counted to 6. Serge and Elaine moved towards the door to the library in a combat stance, their berettas in front of them in outstretched hands. Elaine ID'd the man they'd just killed.
"It's the Nigerian."
"Merde,"
said Serge, and he depressed the button on his walkie-talkie, just as the grenade on the floor by the dead man's body exploded. Lloyd and the tech both jumped at the sound of the hand grenade 2 floors directly below them. The noise came not from the raging gunfight in the foyer, but instead back towards the rear of the building. The sound also came through the speakers of their radios. Kurt Riegel chanced a quick look out the window again. He saw the black Eurocopter drift in and out of the morning mist as it flew off to the south. Below, near the marble fountain in the garden, 2 men moved low in a crouch. They were black, small, they carried machine pistols, and they wore black ski jackets.
"The kill squad from Botswana has arrived, or maybe these are the Liberians."
Riegel said it to the room without emotion.
"It's a virtual United Nations of assholes around here," said Lloyd from behind.
The German watched the 2 Africans as they crossed the grass towards the steps up to the back door. He did not shoot at them. With the gray man in the building, Kurt felt there was a better chance these Botswanans would be more help than hindrance. Riegel said,
"Let's barricade this room. The 3 of us will have to hold everyone off until the helicopter arrives from Paris."
"Even if I survive this, you are going to kill me, aren't you?"
Lloyd asked. Riegel answered as he slipped his pistol back into its shoulder holster underneath his jacket.
"Gentry was right. You've got more to worry about than me right now. Come and help me."
He lifted a chair to put it in front of the door to the spiral staircase.
"Be that as it may," said Lloyd, "I prefer dealing with any threat at the most advantageous opportunity."
Riegel's back was to Lloyd. He stopped, put the chair down, squared his shoulders, and turned slowly. The American attorney's silver automatic was leveled at Kurt's chest. They were 20 feet apart.
"Put down that damn gun. Come on, man. We don't have time for this. There will be time enough for the aftermath of the operation after we get out of here.
The tech sat at the desk and watched the two men intently. He said not a word. Lloyd said,
I could have had the bastard. I could have saved the contract. Your operation failed, not mine.
If you say so, Lloyd.
No, I want you to say so. Take out your phone slowly. Call Mr. Laurent and tell him your plan was fucked up. Take responsibility for this.
And then you'll shoot me. Think, Lloyd. He'll know I was speaking under duress.
For the first time, they heard gunshots on the third floor, far down the corridor from their position.
We need to seal off the room now. We'll talk after that.
Take out your phone. Make the call. No tricks.
Kurt sighed and slowly reached into his jacket with his right hand. His eyes narrowed on Lloyd.
Instead of the phone, Riegel put his hand around the butt of his stire.
As he began to draw the gun from its concealment, prepared to dive to the side to duck the lawyer's inevitable gunfire, he noticed Lloyd's eyes had turned away from him and focused on something behind.
Kurt took the opportunity to pull the stire, and he leveled it at the American's chest.
Just as he was about to fire at the distracted Lloyd, a voice called out from behind.
Did I come at a bad time?
Chapter 35.
You're bleeding bad, Kurt, said Lloyd.
His pistol remained pointed at Riegel. His back remained to the open doorway to the third floor corridor, but his eyes were on the bloody man in the tactical gear. The gray man had appeared silently through the door from the spiral staircase, and while Lloyd had been fixated on Kurt's hand inside his jacket, Gentry had gotten the drop on him. He held a squat, evil-looking submachine gun at eye level, its barrel centered on Lloyd's chest.
Drop the gun, said Gentry.
Who are you speaking to?
Asked Kurt, his back to the gray man. To see Gentry, he would have to take his eyes off of Lloyd, and he was not about to do that. Kurt replied,
If you have a gun in your hand, asshole, then I'm speaking to you.
Lloyd said,
You aren't going to make it much longer, Kurt, old buddy. Your face is white, you're weak, your blood is staining the floor. I'll live long enough to kick your ass. Drop your weapons. You, at the table. Stand up slowly.
The tech was the first to do as he was told. He stood with his hands high over his head, shaking from fear. Lloyd began lowering his pistol. Kurt Riegel followed suit. The German turned his eyes from Lloyd to look at the tech for an instant. And in that instant, Lloyd put a bullet through Kurt Riegel's chest. The big German grabbed the wound and then fell to his side.
The stire bounced away on the hardwood floor.
The tech screamed in fear. The gray man fired a burst at Lloyd as he disappeared through the doorway to the hall. Kurt fought a dizzy spell, an inevitable consequence of his dropping blood pressure. He wobbled on his knees and his eyes glazed over. His brain seemed to reboot, and when his head cleared, he realized he'd lowered the MP5 to his side. Quickly, he raised it at the man with the ponytail and the headphones who stood by the desk with the computers. The man had not moved a muscle apart from the quivering in his shaking hands over his head. Gentry realized he could have been knocked down with a feather there for a few seconds. He was glad the man in the ponytail was too terrified to try it.
Who are you?
Kurt asked.
Just a technician, sir. I run the comms and whatnot. I have no quarrel with you.
At least you didn't try to tell me you're the butler.
Sir?
Kurt crossed the room to the man. On the way, he kept his weapon trained on the open door to the corridor,
and he kicked the stire pistol farther away from Riegel's body as he passed.
On the tech's desk, Kurt found the classified SAD files.
Is this everything?
As far as I know, sir.
No backups, no copies?
I don't believe so.
Kurt scooped them up and tossed them into the fireplace. He ordered the tech to set them alight. Once the files began to burn, the gray man turned the technician around and pushed him back down to his seat, facing the equipment in front of him.
You're the one who communicates with the men hunting me?
Oh, no, sir. Not me. I just maintain the elect...
Then I guess I don't need your ass, do I?
The tech began nodding quickly,
changed his tune in a single note.
Yes, sir. I'm in charge of all communication and coordination between the pavement artists and the government operatives.
Good. Call them all. Tell them I just jumped out the window and I'm escaping through the orchard in the back.
Right away, sir.
The tech's hands shook mightily as he flipped switches on his radio console to bring up every radio channel at the same time.
All elements, this is the tech. Subject has exfiltrated the chateau. He's moving to the north through the orchard on foot.
Well done. Now, take off your belt.
The tech did as he was told quickly and offered it to the gray man.
Bite down on it hard.
Sir?
Do it.
Wide-eyed, the tech put his belt in his mouth.
You biting down?
Asked Gentry. The tech nodded.
Good.
Court smashed his rifle's butt into the man's temple. The tech started to fall from his chair, but Gentry caught his unconscious head and laid it face down on the table in front of him. Gentry then fired a full magazine into the computers and radios on the desk. Court reeled from another dizzy spell, but recovered and reloaded the rifle. He checked on the burning documents in the fireplace. Satisfied that this part of the operation had been successfully completed, he exited into the third-floor corridor, his small rifle out in front of him. Claire Fitzroy was the first to hear the footfalls outside the door. There'd been some close shooting, right outside even, a few minutes earlier. But since then, it had been quiet. But now someone else was coming. She squeezed Grandpa Donald's shoulder tightly from fear. Her little eyes blinked hard from the stress, but they stayed focused on the bottom of the door to the hallway. She heard the clang of metal on wood, more shuffling, and then the rattling of the latch. The door opened slowly, and Claire felt her grandpa's thick arm squeeze tighter around the gun in his hand, now pointed at two sets of feet entering the room. The left boot of the man in the back was wet and red.
"It's you in, Sir Donald. Don't fire!"
Claire started to crawl out with Grandpa Donald, but he pushed her back. He'd no sooner stood up when she heard talking. Grandpa said,
"Bloody good to see you, my boy.
Where are the girls?"
Claire recognized Mr. Jim's voice, and now nothing could have stopped her from crawling out from under the bed. When she stood, she ran to him, crashed into his leg and waist, and hugged him tighter than she'd ever hugged anything in her life. It was a few seconds before she backed away and looked up at him. He wore a black vest on his chest, and guns, and bags on a belt, and hanging off his legs. In his hand was a rifle, and his face and bald head were white as parchment paper, and his brown pants were covered in blood. His eyes were red and watery. Sweat dripped from his face like rainwater. Grandpa Donald noticed the stains on Jim's clothes, too.
"Is that your blood, lad?"
"No, it's not. But I was borrowing it."
"Bloody hell, man, you need a doctor."
"I'm good." Gentry motioned to the Scottish guard standing next to him. "This guy says he's with you."
"Ewan has been quite helpful."
"You trust him enough for me to hand him a weapon?"
There was a slight pause.
"I do." And then, "Just watch yourself, McSpatten."
"Aye, sir."
Court unslung the MP5 from his neck and handed it to McSpatten. Gentry pulled his Glock from his hip rig, kept it in his hand at his side.
"Where's Lloyd? I think I hit him, but he got away from me. I figured he'd be down here taking hostages."
"Haven't seen the cunt," said Grandpa Donald, and Gentry looked down to Claire and Kaint.
"Don, the language?"
"Sorry."
Court looked around.
"And Elise?"
McSpatten and Sir Donald pulled Mrs. Fitzroy from under the bed by her arms. McSpatten hefted her onto his shoulder and hefted the Heckler & Koch submachine gun out in front of him as he moved. Ewan led the way, with Sir Donald limping from his wounds behind him, wielding the stainless steel revolver. The two girls followed on the heels of their grandfather, and Gentry brought up the rear, staggering behind slowly now, bracing himself on the corridor's walls and the railing of the stairs. Once Claire tried to hold him up, but he just smiled at her, said he was fine, and that she should stay close to her grandfather. The caravan moved slowly, as it was comprised chiefly of children, the injured, and the wholly unconscious. After a time, they made it down the stairs to the first floor foyer. Gentry called out from behind.
Girls, look right at your grandpa's back. Straight ahead, you understand? Don't look around the room.
Around them in the huge hardwood and stone entry was utter carnage. Four bodies right inside the blasted open doors, two more bloody corpses in the middle of the room, and another two on the staircase alongside them as they descended. Both of the little girls began to cry. Kate coughed in the thick stench of cordite and blasted stone dust and burnt wood. At the base of the stairs, a prostrate figure moved and writhed. It was a bearded Middle Eastern man. He was alive, on his side. McSpadden passed him, as did the rest. Court was the last one to the injured man. Their eyes met for a second, but Court did not slow to help him. The gray man showed no mercy to his enemies. They moved out of the foyer and into an open sitting room, untouched by battle. The walls were lined with large family portraits. McSpadden paused to get a better hold on the Fitzroy woman, and Gentry leaned against the wall for a moment's rest. Just then, a shirtless man entered from the far doorway. He was one of the Belarusian guards. He had a neck injury he'd wrapped with a towel, but his Kalashnikov remained in his right hand. Surprised by the entourage in front of him, he lifted his weapon quickly. Sir Donald opened fire with the revolver, blasting the shirtless man back through the doorway and onto his back. The girls covered their eyes and shrieked. Court lifted his head slowly when it was all over. He had not even been aware of the threat. Quickly, he spun his head back around him, certain Lloyd would be standing behind him, but there was no one there. Court's knees weakened, and he fell backwards, stumbled into and over a narrow table, and smashed it to the floor. Fitzroy and the two girls ran to him and pulled him back to his feet. They steadied him while he regained his balance.
"I'm all right. Keep moving."
The six of them made it out a side door to a pathway that led around to the graveled parking circle in the back. Still, the Scotsman led the way, the unconscious woman over his shoulder. In the distance of the misty apple orchard, they could hear a smattering of gunfire. Apparently, the kill squads were engaging one another in the fog. Sir Donald found a large black BMW sedan, saw the keys in the ignition, and instructed everyone to climb in as fast as possible. Court had lagged behind. Claire turned and ran back to him, held him up, and this time he did not protest. Twice, Gentry looked back over his shoulder for any sign of Lloyd. Both times, his head spun and reeled with the movement. At a snail's pace, he staggered, only able to do so now with the nominal assistance of an 8-year-old girl. Claire struggled to hold Jim up. It seemed as if with each step he put more weight on her shoulders. He grunted and winced as they moved along the gravel towards the big black car. The guard from Scotland gave his gun to his grandpa Donald and put Mummy in the back seat, and Kate climbed in with her. The guard got behind the wheel, and Grandpa sat in the front passenger seat. The engine started, and Jim nudged Claire in front of him, urged her to run on ahead to the car. She did as she was told, climbed into the back seat, and turned to help pull her rescuer in behind her. Jim was a few steps back, but nearing. He smiled weakly as their eyes met. A single gunshot rang out from the chateau. Claire was looking at Jim as his eyes widened and his body lurched forward, nearly propelling him into the vehicle, but not quite. The American dropped to his knee pads on the gravel, looked up to the Scotsman behind the wheel, and cried out,
"Go!"
The big car lurched ahead. Claire's door slammed shut with the movement. She shrieked as she spun around to look out the back window. She banged her little hands against the glass. On the gravel behind them, Jim teetered forward off his knees, then fell hard on his face. A dust cloud from the car's wheels in the gravel whited out Claire's view of the man left behind. Chapter 36. Court pulled himself pitiably across the gravel drive with his arms. His legs barely moved, and pebbles stuck to the blood on his forearms and face, and in the sweat on his scalp. It was 5 yards to the wet grass. From there, it was 200 yards to the edge of the apple orchard. At the pace he was moving, it would be nightfall before he reached any measure of cover. It was hopeless, but he moved without rationale, only instinct. Get out of the kill zone. Destination unimportant.
"Yo, tough guy! Where the hell do you think you're going?"
Lloyd's shout came from behind. It was followed by the crunching of shoes on gravel. The footfalls closed quickly.
"I have to admit, you've lived up to your hype. You torched the SAD files and you got the Fitzroys. Looks like you managed to save everyone's ass but your own."
Court kept crawling on his bloody forearms into the cold, wet lawn. Lloyd finally stepped on his back to stop him. The gray man looked over his shoulder with a wince. The lawyer held a small Beretta pistol out in front of him. His left arm and shoulder were bloody and limp. Lloyd seemed unfazed by his wounds.
"I shot you in the back. Not terribly noble, I suppose. I didn't know you had a vest on. Bet that still hurt, huh?"
Court rolled slowly on his back. The morning sky had blued considerably since he'd entered the chateau, maybe 15 minutes earlier. Lloyd stood over him and looked straight down. Court knew his Glock had skidded away somewhere when he fell. He had no strength to lift his head to look for it.
"I still don't remember you, Lloyd." Gentry said it through a raspy cough. "Well, you'll remember me in hell, won't you? My face will be the last fucking thing you see."
Lloyd lifted the pistol to Court Gentry's face, and a shot rang out. Lloyd cocked his head, a show of confusion. The young lawyer staggered forward a half-step. Blood appeared on his lips and in his nostrils. His eyes remained on Court, though the lids narrowed. He steadied himself and again raised the gun to Court's chest. From behind came another shot, then another. Lloyd spasmed with each crack. His Beretta fired, but it was low by his side now. The bullet kicked up a spray of white stones between Gentry's legs as the gray man just lay on his back and watched. Lloyd dropped his pistol in the gravel, then crumpled down on top of it, dead. For several seconds, Court just stared at the sky. Finally, he forced his head up, looked back to the chateau. Regal was in a third-floor window, the glass shattered in front of him, his pistol now trained on Gentry. Slowly, the German lowered his gun to his side. The two men just looked at one another for a few seconds. They were both too weak for words, too far apart for eye contact. But the long acknowledgement showed a sense of mutual respect. Two warriors, each recognizing the efforts of the other. Kurt Regal fell backwards and disappeared from view. Court dropped his head back in the grass. Through the ringing in his ears, he noticed the distinctive sound of a helicopter. It was not the black Eurocopter. It was a bigger ship, steadily approaching from the east. His head did not rise back off the dewy grass, but he rolled it to the right in time to see the large, white Sikorsky land 75 yards away. Laurent Group was written in blue on the side. Armed men poured from the vehicle, a half dozen or so. They began moving towards the chateau carefully. Then the aircraft disgorged a trio of men in orange jackets carrying backpacks. Doctors or EMTs or some other sort of emergency personnel. Lastly, 3 men in suits crouched low as they ducked under the rotor's wash. One carried a notebook of some sort, another hefted 2 large briefcases, and a third, who was much older, wore his suit across his back like a cape. Like a Frenchman. Court lost interest in the activity and went back to enjoying the beautiful sky. A minute later, or maybe it was 10, a rifleman stood over him, but he seemed to be more interested in Lloyd's body lying alongside. The Frenchman shouted into a radio. Shortly thereafter, the three men in suits appeared. Court raised himself up to his elbows as they approached. The older man, with the coat for a cape, was unfamiliar to Gentry, but Court figured from his bearing and his dominion over the other two that this could be none other than Mark Laurent.
"Monsieur Gentry, I presume."
Court said nothing. The little man with the notepad on Laurent's right stepped forward and kicked him with an expensive-looking shoe. Court did not feel the blow. His entire body had gone numb.
"When Monsieur Laurent asks you a question, you answer."
"It's okay, Pierre. He's unwell."
Laurent looked around him at the bodies and broken glass and smoke billowing from the roof of the chateau.
"Pierre, make a note. We'll need to move the board of directors' Christmas retreat this year. I don't believe we will have the property cleaned up in time."
"Oui, Monsieur Laurent."
"Mr. Gentry, I see young Mr. Lloyd there. He appears to be about as useful as ever. Would you happen to know where I could find Herr Riegel?"
Court spoke softly, sleepily.
"Lloyd killed him. He killed Lloyd. There was some interdepartmental rivalry in your cooperation shortly before you arrived." "I see."
Laurent shrugged, as if his people died all the time, and it was of no special concern to him.
"I knew nothing of what was going on here," said Laurent,
and Gentry did not respond. The statement was made in the way a man in power says something manifestly untrue. He had no concern whether the Grey Man believed him or not, only that it was put out there, as if to fulfill legal obligations. Implausible deniability. The next words from Laurent's mouth surprised Court.
"I am in need of a man."
He looked around at the bright morning.
"It's a problem, you see. A fellow with whom I've had a long-standing business relationship has outlived his usefulness, and if that wasn't bad enough, he's in possession of information that might prove embarrassing to myself and my pursuits. Allowing him to continue on in his present course of action would serve no one's interests."
Mark Laurent seemed almost bored. He looked at the fresh manicure of his fingernails.
"And, as it happens, I understand you are the man to see about such problems. Might you be available?"
Court was up on his elbows in the wet grass. He turned his head to the left and to the right, and took a moment to regard Lloyd's body. Gentry said,
"I am kind of in the middle of something at the moment."
Laurent waved his hand dismissively.
"Oh, I can see to that." "That would be good,"
Court replied with extreme understatement.
"And as I understand it, you might just have a personal interest in the demise of former president and now regular citizen Julius Abubakar. Rumor is you eliminated his brother, and now the former president is arranging attempts on your life."
Court blinked twice before answering.
"I've heard that rumor as well, Mr. Laurent."
Laurent nodded.
"Abubakar has made certain claims about me, all lies, of course. I run a business based on integrity and impeccable core values of honesty."
Gentry's facial expression did not change.
"No doubt. Still, sometimes sensational claims can take on a life of their own, raise unnecessary concerns, invite uncomfortable scrutiny. I'd like to avoid that if possible."
"So you want me to kill him?"
Laurent nodded.
"I'd pay handsomely for your services."
Court hesitated.
"I just see one little problem with your proposal."
The Frenchman's eyebrows rose.
"And what would that be?"
"I am bleeding to death."
Laurent chuckled, snapped his fingers, and the three men in orange jackets appeared with a stretcher.
"No problem, young man,"
said Laurent, as Court dropped from his elbows and passed out. He relived the conversation in a dream, and thought it later to be one of the oddest and most fanciful dreams he'd ever had.
Epilogue. There were only 4 days left until the Christmas break, and Mummy had told the girls they could wait until after the New Year to return to school. Kate had taken Mummy up on the offer, but Claire declined. Routine is important for a child. She wanted to get back into the swing of things. Maybe it would help her forget. She would love to forget Daddy's funeral, the chateau in France, the noise and the fear and the guns and the blood. She would love to forget leaving Mr. Jim behind. Grandpa Donald had promised her that Jim had gotten away, but she did not believe a thing Grandpa Donald told her anymore. She knew that Jim, like Daddy, was dead. She entered Hyde Park. She always cut through on her way to school, walked purposefully east on North Carriage Drive, turned down a footpath that led over to North Row, and then shortly to her school on North Audrey Street. Her mummy wanted to walk her to school, but Claire had said no. She wanted everything to be the same as when Daddy was around. She'd walk herself to school, walk herself home. A man sat on a bench by the footpath. She paid him no attention until he called her name as she passed. "Hello, Claire." She stopped in her tracks and turned to face Jim. Her knees weakened from shock, and she dropped her school books to the footpath. "I didn't mean to scare you. Your granddad told me you did not believe that I was okay. I just wanted to come and show you that I'm fine." She hugged him, her mind not quite accepting that he was there.
You were awfully hurt. Are you feeling better?"
she asked in a sob of joy. "I'm all better." He stood and smiled and took a few steps up the pavement and then back to her. "See, I don't even need you to help me walk anymore." Claire laughed and hugged him again. Tears filled her eyes.
"You must come to the house straight away. Mummy would so love to see you. She doesn't even remember you being there in France."
Jim shook his head. "I'm sorry, I have to go. I only have a few minutes." She frowned.
"Are you still working for my grandpa?"
Jim looked off into the distance. "I'm working for someone else right now. Maybe Don and I will patch things up someday."
"Jim?"
She sat down on the bench, and he followed her lead.
"The people who killed my father. You killed them, right?"
"They won't hurt anyone else, Claire, I promise."
"That's not what I asked. Did you kill them?"
"Many people died, good and bad, but that is all over now. That's all I can really tell you. I can't help you make sense of it all. Maybe someone else can. I hope so. But not me. I'm sorry." Claire looked across the park.
"I'm glad Grandpa Donald wasn't lying about you."
"Me too." It was quiet for a moment. Jim began to shuffle a little on the bench. Claire said,
"You have to go now, right?"
"I'm sorry. I have to catch a plane."
"That's okay. I have to go to school. Routine is important."
"Yeah." He paused. "I guess it is." They both stood, hugged again. "Take care of your sister and your mother, Claire. You're a strong girl. You will be fine."
"I know, Jim. Merry Christmas,"
she said to him, and then they both said goodbye. Court walked slowly out of the park and onto Upper Grosvenor Square. The limp he had managed to hide from Claire had returned, and he winced with each step. A black Peugeot sedan idled just outside the gate. He ducked into the back seat without a word to the occupants. Two Frenchmen in suits turned to face him from the front. One handed him a satchel as the car pulled into traffic. Quietly, Court opened it, checked its contents, and zipped it shut. The middle-aged Frenchman in the passenger seat said,
"The jet is waiting at Stansted. 3 hours flying time. You should be in Madrid by early afternoon."
Court did not respond. He only looked out the window.
"Abu Bakr will arrive at his hotel at 6. Are you sure you have enough time to prepare?"
Still nothing from the American. We have arranged their room on the floor directly below his suite. Gentry just stared at the park as it passed. Children walked with their parents, lovers arm in arm. The Frenchman in the passenger seat rudely snapped his fingers in front of Gentry's face, as if admonishing an inattentive servant.
Monsieur, are you listening?
The gray man turned slowly to the man. His eyes were clearer now. Understood. No problem. Plenty of time. The older Frenchman barked.
I don't need you fucking this up.
And I don't need your advice. It's my show. I call the time and location.
You are my property, monsieur. We have spent a lot of money on your recovery. You will do as you are told.
Court wanted to protest, wanted to reach into the front seat and break the passenger's neck, but he checked his urges. Kurt Riegel's successor was a bigger asshole than Kurt Riegel, but he was also Gentry's boss. If only for the time being.
Yes, sir,
said Court, though he wanted to say more. He turned his head back to the window, caught a final glimpse of the southern tip of the park, the lovers and the children, and the families and the lives of others so incredibly different from his own. The Peugeot turned left on Piccadilly, left the park behind, and melted into the heavy traffic of London's morning commute.
This has been an Audible Inc. presentation of The Gray Man, written by Mark Greaney, narrated by Jay Snyder. Executive producer, Steve Feldberg. Producer, Mike Charzik. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 2009, Mark Strode Greaney. Production copyright 2010 by Audible Inc.
And now a free preview of On Target, Book 2 in the Gray Man series.
Prologue. Dark clouds hung low above the Irish Sea, fat in the moist morning air, and tracked slowly over the assassin as he stood on the wooden foredeck of the fishing boat. A few screeching herring gulls had encircled the vessel while it was still miles offshore. Now that it had entered the harbor channel, a flock one dozen strong swarmed above and around, churning the mist with their white wings. The seabirds shrieked at the vessel, bleated warnings to the Irish coast of the arrival of a killer to its shores. But their warnings were lost in the vapor. The boat docked in its harbor slip just before 8 a.m., The assassin climbed off the deck and onto the quay without a glance at the two crew members. Not a single word had been exchanged in the 3 hours since the 40-foot Lochan had picked its passenger up from a Lithuanian freighter in international waters. He remained on the deck, moving fore and aft, vigilantly scanning the roiling sea around him, his black hooded raincoat protecting him from the salty spray and the occasional shower, as well as the curious eyes of the father and son who operated the boat. The crew remained in the wheelhouse during the journey, following strict instructions. They had been told to pick up a passenger and then keep away from him, to return him to Howth Harbor just north of Dublin. After delivering this odd catch of the day, they were to enjoy their payment and hold their bloody tongues. The assassin walked through the seaside village to the tiny train depot and bought a ticket to Connolly Station in central Dublin. With half an hour to kill, he stepped down the station steps and into the basement pub. The bloody scream served a full Irish breakfast for the fishermen in the harbor. The long, narrow room was more than half full of men wolfing down plates of eggs and sausage and baked beans, washing it all down with pints of ink-dark, foamy Guinness stout. The assassin knew how to assimilate in unfamiliar surroundings. He grunted and gestured to hide his foreign accent, and ordered the same as those around him. He dug into his plate and drained his beer before leaving the bloody scream to catch his train. A half hour later, he trudged through Dublin. He wore his brown beard thick and a blue watch cap down over his ears and forehead, a scarf tight around his neck, and a dark blue peacoat into which his gloved hands dug deep to hide from the frigid air. Hanging over a shoulder, a small canvas bag swung with his footsteps. He headed south, away from the train station, then turned right at the quay of the River Liffey and followed it as chilled rain began to fall. The assassin walked on. He looked forward to getting this errand behind him. He had not been comfortable at sea, nor was he comfortable now in the morning crowd growing around him as he neared O'Connell Street. But there was a man here in Dublin who, it had been decided by someone with money and influence, should cease to exist. And Court Gentry had come to see to that. Chapter 1 At a pharmacy, he bought a pack of acetaminophen tablets and a bottled water. He'd been injured a few months back, a bullet through the thigh and a knife blade into his gut. The pain had lessened by the week. The body had incredible power to heal, so much greater than that of the mind. Court had grown dependent on the pills and injections, Vicodin and Oxycontin, Demerol and Dilaudid. A surgeon in Nice had kept him supplied since the operation to clean and close his abdominal wound, and Gentry had popped pills each day since. But he'd purposely left them behind when he boarded the freighter. He'd gone over a week now without his meds, and this self-imposed detox was making him miserable. The acetaminophen was no substitute for a heavy narcotic, but his mind found comfort in the ritual of swallowing the tablets nonetheless. 3 hours after leaving the boat, he checked into a Chinese-run budget hotel in a narrow alley off Parnell Street, a half-mile north of the river. His room was dark and dank and smelled of mold and frying grease. The restaurant 2 floors below him blew the stench through the vents. A near-horizontal rain beat steadily on the dirty window but failed to clean it. The oily grime covered the inside of the glass. Gentry lay on his back on the sagging mattress and stared at the ceiling, his thoughts unfocused. He'd been on a boat for over a week. It felt odd not swaying back and forth, rising slowly up and down. It took hours to drift to sleep, the cold rain unceasing on the pain next to his head. In the mid-afternoon, he sat at the Chinese restaurant in the tiny hotel, ate noodles and pork, and used a store-bought mobile phone to log onto the internet. He accessed a bulletin board on a website that sold adventure tours of the Ural Mountains, entered a password to log onto a forum for employees. With a further code, he gained entry to a thread with one other viewer. Court typed on his phone with his thumb while he drank tepid orange juice. "I'm here." A few seconds later, the tiny window in the phone refreshed. Someone had replied on the forum. "In Bangkok, I trust." This was the code that confirmed the identity of the other party. Gentry's identity was established with his reply. "No, Singapore." Only by the misspelling was the identity check complete. "Nice journey, my friend," came the next reply. Court read it, bit into a fried wonton as greasy as the window in his upstairs room. He tried not to roll his eyes. It had not been a nice journey, and Gregor Ivanovich Sidorenko was not Court Gentry's friend. Court had no friends, and it was unlikely Sidorenko, or Sid, to all those in the West who knew of him, had any himself. He was Russian mob, an overboss in St. Petersburg. He ran an organization that controlled illegal gambling and drugs and hookers and hitmen, and, out of desperation on the part of the American assassin, he now ran Court Gentry, the Grey Man. While ostensibly in the same line of work, Gregor Sidorenko was no Donald Fitzroy. Sir Donald had been Court's handler for years, ever since the CIA had chased Gentry out of the U.S. with a burn notice and a shoot-on-sight directive. Fitzroy had taken him in, had offered him good jobs against bad men, had paid him fairly for his work, and had even once hired him to protect his own family. But then Fitzroy had been pushed into a corner, had turned on Court, and though he'd apologized profusely and even offered up his life to his American employee in recompense, Gentry knew he could never trust him again. He would never trust anyone again. Sid was scum, but he was a known quantity. Court knew he couldn't trust the forked-tongued Russian fuck as far as he could throw him, but Sid could supply access to some of the most lucrative contracts in the industry.
and Sid agreed to Gentry's caveat that he would only accept those hits he deemed righteous, or at least those that tipped slightly to the good side of the morally neutral category, which had led Court here to Ireland. This trip to Dublin was Court's first stop for Sid. He'd read the dossier of the target, agreed to the job, argued online about the low wages offered for the contract, and then reluctantly accepted. He needed to stay operational. The downtime and the wounds and the drugs were softening him, and he was a man who absolutely could not afford to soften. Court had memorized the relevant portions of the target's dossier, standard operating procedure before a wet operation. Name, Dougal Slattery. Age, 54 years. Nationality, Irish. Height, big. Weight, fat. He'd been a boxer as a young man, but couldn't break out of the thick mid-list of the local pugilistic talent. Then he found work as a tough guy, a bouncer in Dublin nightclubs. He branched out, did some rough stuff for a local syndicate, slapping around lazy Polish hookers and knocking Turkish drug dealers' heads together for not making quota. He graduated to some low-level killings, gang versus gang stuff, nothing fancy, till he was sent on an errand to the continent. In Amsterdam, he'd made the big time, killing his boss's rival in a hail of bullets after using his gnarled fists to bash in the faces of two of his bodyguards. From there, he'd climbed to the second tier of the killer-for-hire trade. Wet jobs in Ankara, in Sardinia, in Calcutta, and Tajikistan. He did not run solo, Court had noticed in his file. He wasn't the brains behind his operations, but his curriculum vitae included some respectable kills. Not respectable in the moral sense, no. He'd reportedly killed a police detective, an honest businessman, a journalist or two. But Court appreciated that the operations themselves had been, if not spectacular, at least competently executed. But his last hit on file was 6 years ago. Court couldn't help but notice that Sid's dossier on Slattery went wafer thin after that. A few speculative inferences aside, all that was known about his life since then was that he played the drum in a traditional Irish band that performed 5 nights a week in the touristy Temple Bar section of Dublin. Hardly work that got your name scribbled onto a termination order. Gentry found this to be one of his more morally neutral operations. The man was a killer, but so was Court. Court rationalized the difference. He vetted his targets, made sure their deeds warranted extrajudicial killing. Dougal Slattery clearly did not. According to Sid, the Irishman was now on retainer for an Italian-run international criminal organization. His next victim might well be a recalcitrant prostitute or the owner of a restaurant that failed to pay protection money to the mafia. Killing Dougal Slattery wouldn't much improve the evil ways of the world, Court decided, but it certainly wouldn't hurt. Well, it wouldn't hurt anyone who was not named Dougal Slattery. Hello, you still there? Sid's previous post was 3 minutes old. Court had drifted off mission for a moment. He forced himself to concentrate on his phone's tiny screen. I'm here, no problems. How long will you need? Unknown. We'll assess situation tonight. Act at first prudent opportunity. I understand, my friend. Don't take too long. I have more work after. There was always more work, Court knew. But most work involved contracts Gentry would never accept. Court would be the judge if there was more work after. He didn't argue the point with Sidorenko, though. Instead, he just replied, Okay. I look forward to good news. До свидания, friend. Court just logged off. He shut down the phone and stuck it inside the side pocket of his peacoat. He finished his meal, paid, and left the hotel. In the late afternoon, he walked the neighborhoods around Grafton Street. He'd spent an hour looking at the dress and mannerisms of the locals, trying to assimilate. It would not be hard for the trained professional. Dublin was an international city full of Poles, Russians, Turks, Chinese, South Americans, even a few Irish here and there. There was no one look or walk or attitude to parrot. Still, Court stepped into a used clothing shop on Dawson Lane and stepped out with a bag. In the bathroom of a department store, he changed into worn blue jeans, a hooded sweatshirt, and a black denim jacket. Black athletic shoes and his dark blue watch cap finished off the ensemble.
By nightfall, he was a local, moving with the masses. He ran a security sweep, backtracked, stepped on and off a few trains on the DART, Dublin's mass transit, all to make sure he was not being followed. There were more people in this world who wanted Court Gentry dead than would ever give a rat's ass about Dougal Slattery, and Court kept this in mind, just to keep his operation in perspective. His secondary objective was to kill the Irishman. The primary objective, as always, was to keep his own ass alive for another day. His persec, or personal security, needed to remain at the forefront of his thoughts. Satisfied he had not grown a tail, he headed to the Temple Bar neighborhood of the southern bank of the River Liffey. At 10 o'clock he sat at the bar at the Oliver St. John Gogarty. Although it was a Wednesday evening, the touristy pub was packed full. Americans, continental Europeans, Asians. The only Irish in the bar were likely the barmaids, the bartenders, and the band. Court hadn't spent much time in raucous juke joints in the past few months. He'd laid low in the south of France, lived in the tiny attic room of a tiny cottage in a tiny hillside village, and rarely ventured out past the little corner market for canned foods and bottled water. Even his few visits into Nice to see his doctor were tame. It was the winter season, the nightclubs and the kitschy shops on the Promenade des Anglais, always bursting at the seams during the tourist season, were nearly empty or boarded up. That was the way Court liked it. The Oliver St. John Gogarty was anathema to his standard tradecraft. Already the female bartender had asked him his name, and two Englishwomen next to him had tried to engage him in small talk. He'd ignored their overtures, sipped his Guinness, scanned the room, wished he had 4 milligrams of Dilaudid to relax him, and then angrily told himself to unfuck himself and get his head back on this job. There are 2 types of people in the world. Only 2. Sheep and wolves. Court was a wolf, and he knew it. The past few months had weakened him somewhat, but a wolf was always a wolf, and it had never been more evident to him than it was here at the bar, surrounded as he was by 100 sheep. No one in the crowd scanned for threats like he did. No one in the crowd had pinpointed the exits and the fit men in the room and the type of glass in the front window. No one in the crowd had taken note of the paucity of law enforcement on the street or the lighting scheme of the back alley. No one in the crowd knew where to sit so no mirror's reflection cast his image about the room. No one in the crowd had a plan to run for his life, if necessary. And no one in the crowd had a plan to kill everyone else in the crowd if it came down to it. Yes, he was in a crowd full of sheep, but there was, in fact, 1 more wolf in the room. According to Sid's dossier, the drummer on stage was a hard man as well. There were 5 in the traditional or trad band, and though Gentry was no expert on such matters, from the reaction of the patrons, he supposed they must have been very good. The big man with the white hair sitting on the bench to the side of the stage played a boron, a traditional handheld Irish drum. He took his work seriously, kept his head down, and leaned forward as if to pick up on the subtleties of the music. He looked to Court more like a middle-aged musician and less like a middle-aged hitman. Maybe it had been a while since he'd worked his day job. Next to him, a young, thin man played a tin whistle into his microphone. The guitarists strummed and sang in harmony, and the crowd of sheep went wild. Court couldn't make out many of the words of the song, but it had something to do with a beautiful young woman and a bad potato harvest and a husband dead from drink. Court finished his stout and headed out the door. Chapter 2 Dougal Slattery said goodbye to his bandmates at 11:30, covered his thick white hair with a Donegal wool walking cap, and left the Oliver St. John Gogarty with his drum in its leather case hanging over his shoulder. It was a cold but clear evening, like 1,000 other nights he'd played in the bar, and also, like most other nights, he fancied a pint before heading back to his flat. There were 3 dozen pubs within a few minutes' walk, but his flat was a mile away on the other side of Perth Station. He'd do what he usually did. Head to his local watering hole for a nightcap. Slattery walked with a limp, a bad knee.
Actually, a bad knee and a worse knee, but limping on both legs was out of the question, so he leaned into the better of the two weakening joints, his thick body lumbering on through the cold night. It took the big Irishman nearly 30 minutes to make it to the pod.